So in my view, the Labor Party has moved away from working people. That they genuinely have, and I think they're onto them. And one of the reasons for that, in my view, is the individuals that they have in the parliament don't come from that background anymore. In the majority, they are not tradespeople. They don't come through the factory floor. They are, you know, lawyers who graduate, who go into an electorate office, who go to a minister's office, who win a pre-selection, who end up in this building. Now, that might be great, but I think it'd be better for the parliament to have a more diverse base to draw from.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. In my little studio this week is the member for Hinkler, Keith Pitt. Now, Pitt is a member of the government, a member of the LNP. I've brought him in predominantly in this conversation to give listeners a perspective, or his perspective, of being on the ground in Queensland in the recent federal election. Beyond that, he and I have a mutual obsession with energy policy, so Keith Pitt is very busy trying to revive a national debate about nuclear energy, so we're going to get into that. And we end this conversation with some reflections about political life in 2019. Pitt's an outspoken sort of character, outspoken Queensland Nat. Listener. Keith, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, great to be with you, and certainly long-time listener, first-time participant.
Well, hopefully not the last.
Well, we'll see.
Oh, now. So let's start in Queensland, which is obviously your home base, and Queensland was, well, the decisive battleground. God, I hate that cliche, but there,
jewel in
there
the crown,
it was.
We prefer.
Well, you would say that, wouldn't you? But it was a very decisive state for the outcome of the election. So let's talk about how that all looked and felt on the ground, and what you think happened over the course of the contest. Because when you all left Canberra, none of you were particularly confident that you were about to sail into the great victory. So what happened?
Well, I think I was probably one of the few that thought it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do what's necessary, and sometimes that is, you know, awkward and uncomfortable for others. But in Queensland, it was a really straightforward issue. It was about people and their jobs. And I think, you know, I'm not here to give free advice to the Labor Party, but if you purport to represent working people, you can't go to them and say that, well, actually, we think we should close your industry and put you out of a job. We know that, you know, you might earn $180,000 a year driving that mine truck, but we just don't like it anymore. So that was a very big deciding factor. And a lot of other individuals, particularly around the, you know, the tax element, the retiree tax, and there was a number of others, it worried them. And you know, they thought of, well, if they can close the resources industry, who's next and is it me? And when you're in regional Queensland in particular, everybody knows the importance of mining. They really do. It's a big driver of the economy. And they're proud people. I mean, this is an industry which has a long history. They're proud of the fact that they deliver for the Australian economy, and in particular the money that builds, you know, schools and roads and hospitals. And I think they're right to be proud of their industry, and they've got every right to continue.
And what sorts of things, it's sort of slightly implicit in your answer, but what were people saying to you in the course of the contest that made you think, oh, actually, maybe we'll be all right here?
There's a little town in my electorate by the name of Torben Lee. Billy's Coffee Roadhouse is a little caravan stop near the school that very fortunately opens at 5 a.m. in the morning. And you know, this was a really consistent theme through the election. There's a you know, gentleman there, obviously, you know, ready to go to work, high vis, boots, all the normal things. And he saw me and he came over and he said, you know, mate, you Keith Pitt? And I said, yeah, mate, how you going? And this was a really common conversation by this stage. And he said, mate, I'm not going to yank your chain. I'm a Labor man, but I want to talk to you. And I said, well, it's fine, mate. Yeah, we represent everyone equally. That's the gig. And he said, I am a lifelong Labor voter. I'm a union organiser. I'm working in South Australia, you know, on whatever the event was, a big construction site. And these are his words. And he said, mate, I'm just torn. He said, I don't know what to do. He said, I don't think I can vote for him, but, you know, I want to talk to you and see what your view is. Now, I saw that gentleman again probably a couple of weeks later. It's just, you know, you just run into one another and just happen to be the same time, same place. And we had another short chat. And he said, you know what, mate? He said, I think I'm going to go with you. And I think this has been one of the fundamental changes in the last election. They were lifelong Labor voters that walked away from them in droves.
And do you think, though, because obviously the Labor had a very poor primary vote in Queensland, very, very poor, but there was obviously a strong protest vote in the state. A lot of that went to Clive Palmer and One Nation and came back to the government. That's one phenomenon. Then you've got to look at the other phenomenon, which you've referenced in that anecdote, which is a long-time Labor voter coming to the coalition, presumably not via a shopfront of Clive Palmer or Pauline or whomever. So did you see both factors in play? Because there was, you know, like in George Christensen's seat, for example, right, there was a huge flight to One Nation and Palmer in that seat, which all came back to him. So again, sort of how did the protest vote manifest and how did you deal with it in terms of trying to boost your own primary vote?
Well, I think there's a few points to be made. And I think the first one is, you know, George has got a safer seat than I do. Mm-hmm. It's quite incredible. Mm-hmm. And I actually had someone say to me the other day, you know, we just don't get you guys. And I said, well, mate, you know, if you're not born there and you don't understand the Queensland thought process, they hate being told what to do, particularly by someone that comes, you know, from Melbourne, from Sydney, from Tasmania, seen as a blow-in, telling them that they can't have a job and they're all horrible people. And and George, I get on very well with George. He's a good mate of mine, and he's actually a really intelligent guy. He's good on his feet. And for them, even though they're throwing every piece of mud they could find, you know, he's theirs, right? Mm. That's our guy.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, if you want to keep throwing mud at him, it's up to us to decide whether he stays or not.
Well, it was a very similar phenomenon. I don't want to cut you off. We'll come back to the point. Yeah. But it was a very similar phenomenon in New England with Barnaby Joyce.
Correct.
When, you know, he might be a dickhead, but he's our dickhead.
Well, I won't quite use those terms, but I mean that.
That's fine.
He's our guy.
Yeah.
And we decide when he goes, not you.
Yes.
I think as a result of a few things, you know, George is a good local member. He honestly is, and they genuinely like him.
Mm.
And I think that's reflected in his result. In terms of the miners, as I said earlier, I mean, some of the rusted on Labor people, yep, they voted for us through gritted teeth. They might have come through a few different pathways depending on what seat you're in. I mean, in 2016, I had one of the highest primary votes for One Nation in the country, almost 20%.
Yeah, yeah.
That was down to under 15.
Yes.
In what I think was probably their strongest candidate.
But that's why I'm asking you, because clearly, you know, I'm not disrespecting George in saying that it was, most of it went via a shop front back to him, right? In your seat, it was a bit different, right? Your primary vote position improved. So.
So George's is my understanding.
Now I'm struggling because it's a little while since I've looked at it. I don't think it went up much. If it did go up, I don't think it went up much. But you managed to, you know, have Vote One Keith repel a bit of leakage to One Nation. So what did you do? How did you do that?
Oh, well, I'd like to think it's not just about me. It's a team game. I mean, you have to put forward the policies that, you know, people appreciate, that work for them. And in my electorate, and this is one of the key drivers for me, one of the KPIs, the white-based statistical area in Australia is actually the one with the lowest per capita income in the country and has been for 20 years. It's not where you think it would be.
Mm.
It is in this, you know, central Queensland location, which has very, very low incomes across the board. And my goal as a federal member is to make sure that's not where we stay.
Yeah.
So, you know, that takes a bit of doing. And I think, you know, people recognise that if you're really having a crack, particularly if you're willing to stand up for things that, you know, they might not agree with you, but they want to know that when it comes right down to it, you'll stand up in their interests. And I think that happened on a few occasions as we came through. And I know there were times where people in my own team didn't agree with what I did.
Well, that's the interesting thing, of course, that it's what might be frowned upon in Canberra is, you know, sort of not playing the team game or whatever locution you want to use, right, actually benefits you locally in terms of being seen to put the members of your constituents first.
Oh, well, it's not about being seen to. You actually do it.
No. Yeah. I mean no disrespect by the question. I know you put your positions very sincerely, but it's also got to be seen. Right. It can't just be done because of it. You know, it's like the tree falls in the forest.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
So it's got to be seen in order to have an impact. So you think that benefited you?
Well, I think it does across the board. You know, I've looked at this stuff in detail now for quite some time, and that local member vote, the fact that they know who you are and what you stand for, that's probably 2 or 3 points primary, I think. At best, I remember when Warren Truss retired, there was a change in the primary vote there of about 3.5-4%, and I thought, well, I'm not sure that it can get much better than that.
Mm.
But once again, you know, this game is about people. And if they think that you're really having a crack on their behalf and you are genuinely acting in their interests, and they know you won't win all the time. You know, I'd like to win all the time, it'd be great, but it just doesn't work that way.
Sure.
So I think that certainly plays into it. But I do think One Nation were off the boil. You know, they had a 5-point drop, basically. Palmer spent an enormous amount of money.
Huge amount of money.
Yeah, but it was about 4%, I think, primary locally. And Labor dropped to around 23% in my seat. So, as you said, Queensland, their primary was terrible.
Yeah, diabolically bad. Absolutely diabolically bad.
And but long may it continue, mind.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. So do you think that local member effect is more important than it used to be? Or do you think it's always been thus?
Oh, no, I think it's ever been ever thus, particularly for regional seats. You know, we know our local people. For me, I was born in the electorate. I grew up there. I went to public school and, you know, like many others, I moved away for, you know, whatever the reason might be. It was university at the time for me. But I did a trade first. I came back, you know, brought a soon-to-be wife with me, and we haven't left since. But, you know, I had local businesses. My family's been there for 4 generations. Mm. You know, people know them.
Mm.
And you genuinely come across guys. And this comes back to the point I made earlier. When someone comes to you and you know them, and when they say that, you know, they're a rusted-on Labor voter, and you genuinely know that's the case.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally were stopping at our roadsides. So when someone's going to work and they see you at the side of the street and they pull over and come to talk to you, well, usually they're going to give you a fair tune.
Yeah.
But we had a number of them, and it was the same thing. You know, we're rusted on. We're Labor people. We're not going to vote from this time. So I think the key in this term is to maintain that trust.
Mm.
And if we can do that, well, we'll be successful again in the next election.
And how do you do that?
Well, you've got to act in their interests. You know, these are common sense working people. You know, they get it. They know what comes across their kitchen table. They know what things cost. They know if they go up or down. And if things are going well for them, well, they don't look to change the government. And I think, once again, it's been ever thus.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about energy now, which is a particular interest of yours and mine. You have been active since the election on restarting a nuclear debate in Australia. So why?
Well, once again, that's feedback from the electorate, from people I talk to. I mean, I started straw polling this at roadsides and things probably a year ago. And the first time I did it, I thought, I that can't be right. I mean, there was 10 or 12 people there and 10 of them said, yep, we should be doing this. And I thought, oh, well, maybe I'm just in the wrong place and it's a, you know, not a good mix of demographic. So we tried it again a few more times and the support level is strong. It really is.
Okay, but is the support level strong in the event that you told your constituents, yes, we're going to have nuclear power and we're going to build a power plant in the electorate?
But this is about a conversation with the Australian people.
Oh, we'll have that in a minute.
Yeah, sure,
we'll
sure.
have that out. But this is the threshold. I ask the question deliberately.
Of course.
Because we've had the nuclear debate in Australia before in the 70s, and we had a go at it under the Howard era as well, and we'll get into the intricacies of that in a sec. But it always founders on this basic proposition that people in principle are okay with nuclear and probably more okay now than they were in the 80s in the spectre of Chernobyl.
Mm.
But if you say the reactor's coming next to you, they say get nicked.
Well, I think this is the case that has to be made. And in my view, the technology has moved on. So, you know, if the facts change, well, you need to re-examine the argument. And I think that's the exact proposition. Like we're looking to have a conversation with the Australian people. It's very easy to run the scare campaign. You know, anybody can do that. Labor's very good at it. We all acknowledge that you can run a scare campaign anytime you like. But it's much more difficult to deliver actual solutions. And I think we should reinvestigate this as an option. And we need to get all the facts on the table and established. And I've had, you know, emails and calls and text messages from all over the country with lots of different, you know, opportunities and types and reactors. And it's been, yeah, quite interesting.
Mm.
But I think, you know, if you're a parliamentarian, one of your purposes in life is to establish what the facts are and make a decision based on those. And if the facts move and if there are other new things to look at and to establish, well, why shouldn't we have the debate?
Oh, well, why shouldn't we indeed? That's fine. But Jay Weatherill had a royal commission into the nuclear sector only really a couple of years ago.
Yep.
Now. So we've actually had a more recent snapshot than the Switkowski snapshot, which was 2006.
Yep.
So I'm being oppositional. I'm not making a case for why we shouldn't have the debate. I'm just putting facts in front of us,
sure.
Right? So in the Wetherill process, basically, you know, and that whole inquiry was actually supportive of the concept, but said, however, it won't be economical, certainly will not be economical without a carbon price, and an ambitious one. And so we get back to this sort of point, which I know you are genuinely worried about, which is the impact of power prices on your constituents. So nuclear power on all available evidence is expensive, will require a carbon price in order to be viable. Now, you in the Nats don't like a carbon price, or do you not mind a carbon price?
Well, I think there's a few things to explore in that. And the first one, my understanding is one of the recommendations from the South Australian Royal Commission was actually for the legislation on the prohibition to change.
Yes.
At a federal level.
Yeah, so, it was positive about. Yeah.
Well, there's only one place that can do that, Catherine, that's here.
Yeah.
So I think we need to recognise that, you know, it is an issue for the federal parliament. In terms of the pricing and all of those other mechanisms, you know, I'm an electrical engineer by profession. I did a trade first. I became a registered professional engineer about 10 years after I finished university. And I've worked in power systems and transmission and all over the place. As a consultant engineer, we had a pretty simple view. They want, they pay, we go.
Mm.
So, you get a very broad spectrum of experience. And what I've seen in this place is, inquiries can be pushed around to get an outcome that you want, particularly around the economics. If we look at the levelised cost, and inside the Finkel review, one of the things that popped up out of that was, batteries and renewable.
Yep.
But what wasn't stated was that backup was 4 hours. Now, I know that is completely unviable, because quite simply, if it rains for a day, well, you run out of energy.
Yeah.
So you can't have the entire national economy rely on something that is that intermittent. So once you accept that that's the case, well, then it becomes a question of what's the mix, and what is the percentage, and from where.
Yeah.
So I think that is one of the keys. And if we look at the wholesale price of power, well, it's increased dramatically. It's not that long ago that $40 was average. It's why coal was the one that was driving most of the energy, because it was affordable and economical at that rate. I mean, I remember looking at Belmont up in Queensland and seeing it for $28 and $23. And now we're talking 70, 80, 100, and potentially a price target of $70 for wholesale. Now, while for your listeners that won't make a lot of sense and doesn't make much difference in terms of their retail price until it passes through, that's a problem.
Mm.
So if we want this country to have an industrial base, then we need to have affordable energy, because without it, we will lose the foundries and factories that drive, in particular, regional Australia.
But I accept your point about firming, and we've got a way to go with firming, obviously, in a technological sense. It's not a magic bullet this second. It's not. But in terms of the cost curve of the various energy options, new coal is expensive. Nuclear is expensive. Now, you're making the point that we need the artist formerly known as baseload power, shall we say?
Right? Very nice.
Well, we need this, right? When the grid is moving in a different direction, we're talking about gas peaking. We're also talking about a grid that is not centralised. So many people, not me. I don't know. Mm. Do you have a PV on your roof? I don't have one.
I have one on a house, because at the time I thought, if you're dumb enough to pay me that much, I'll take it. And can I tell you, the inverter burned out in 18 months and had to be replaced.
Right.
And
so you don't have one. I don't have one. But a load of people now do have
Correct.
Them.
And there's nothing wrong with it.
And battery storage. So.
But you can't run the country on it.
No, sure. No. I accept your engineering point, but I'm just saying, how do you reconcile your two objectives? Because you are concerned, for all the right reasons, that your households in your electorate don't, freeze to death in winter because they can't turn the heater on.
They just can't pay now.
Well, that's what I mean. Mm. I'm not being ridiculous, but it's like they're almost, though, two different objectives that are difficult to reconcile. There's sort of what the country needs, quote unquote, in terms of, 24/7 energy, but the price of 24/7 energy in an environment where the grid is, moving back to households, where people are talking about gas peakers, where no one is building baseload, It's pretty expensive. So where's your wand, Keith?
But
where's your magic wand?
Yes, but these are one of the arguments for the inquiry. And you do need to look at the actual factual realities of the economics. One of the things that hasn't really been talked about, and it's a really technical issue that most people won't get, is those ancillary services that are provided inherently in the big generators.
You're going to get us into FCAS, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. But once again, if it's not there, there's got to be paid for in another way.
Yeah.
So that needs to be priced.
Yeah.
You need to determine what your actual reliability standard is. And I'm not talking about the market reliability standard for, pay, don't pay, if it shows up or doesn't show up. This is an actual technical reliability standard around the equipment being available. How often does it work? At what percentage? And these things were always much simpler when you had distributed major generation systems that then just pushed out. But when you come back to solar PV on houses, the Finkel report was pretty accurate in my view. So roughly $550 a year less for people that had it. But the ones that don't have it are the ones who rent, who can't afford to pay, and they get it in the neck.
Yeah,
and this is what
right.
I said in 2015, right? It's why I spoke against the RET, because in my view it would push up the price. It would be paid for by the poorest people. It would make the system less reliable. Saying I'll just say it doesn't really help anyone. So these are the reasons we need to look at all of these things with an open mind and clear eyes. There is an opportunity to do that now and include nuclear, but it has to be bipartisan. If the Labor Party come out and want to pick a fight, well, this is dead, right? There's just no way to do that. So I genuinely think we should have the inquiry and the debate. We can look at these things from a factual position and make a decision based around that, because right now we are not getting the outcomes the Australian people need.
And if the inquiry comes back saying that nuclear power is not viable without a carbon price, which is what every recent inquiry has done, what do you say, Keith Bitt?
Well, I think the real question is that inherent in the cost that we have now? These are the other challenges.
So, oh, you're not going to actually tell me we've got a shadow carbon price.
I'm not saying anything of the type.
Those, yes, didn't pass your lips.
No,
but seriously.
But I'm a practical guy, right? If the price comes down, well, that's great, and that's what we need to do. But right now it's not.
No, but there's a very specific question here which you are declining to answer. If nuclear requires a carbon price, is that okay?
Well, it's not a matter of whether it's okay or not. I'm not going to preempt what the outcomes of the inquiry may or may not be. I've seen the comments from the ANU, and all of those things may well be accurate. What I've learned here very, very early in the 6 years I've been here is never commit yourself to something when you don't know what the outcomes are yet, and that's what I intend to do right now.
So maybe a carbon price is okay.
Well, you can push as hard as you like, but let's see if we can get the inquiry up first, and then we see what the outcomes are.
No, but it's interesting because Cory Bernardi, who's very much in your column on the nuclear thing, is of the view, well, let's have the inquiry. It's all you, Butte, but boy, if there's a carbon price, but you're not saying that.
But I could make the argument that the Greens will say never, 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 no way. And I'm sure that they will want to participate in any inquiry if it gets up, and I think that's fine. And it's the point I make to the opposition. It's easy to run a scare campaign. It's much more difficult to put up with solutions. And why would you be scared of an inquiry? So I think there are options right across the board. We can demonstrate, we are actually adults in this building after, 10 years of relative turmoil. And I think there's an opportunity here for all of us.
Well, you've given me the segue with the adults in the building and 10 years of turmoil. So let's talk a bit now about contemporary political life, because this is a semi-ongoing project associated with this podcast. I've had all kinds of people in here over the last couple of years talking about political life in quite refreshing and frank ways. What do you make of it? Because you're a late convert, in inverted commas.
I think I'm a better electrician than I am politician, but I'll quote Craig Launty. How's that?
Yeah.
Craig and I get on very well. We don't agree on everything, but we get on very well, as I'm sure you do.
Mm.
And he told me very early in the first term, he said, mate, you are outspoken and opinionated and I love it, but nobody else does. So I think that it may well be an accurate description.
Mm. Why do you think that modern politics is very intolerant of dissent? Why do you think? Internal dissent, I mean. Is it political culture, or is it media culture, or is it both?
Oh, I think it's a combination of both. One of the very interesting parts of my job here is, as I said, I have a profession which people used to pay me reasonably well for to get advice. And on something where you're actually a technical expert, so many people in this building want to tell you that they know more than you do. And coming from outside, that's been something that's been very difficult to accept, that, there's a lot of experts in the building, all sorts of things that, aren't necessarily right all the time, if I can be as polite as that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is one of the challenges. you know, like all of us, you always like to see birds of a feather because you know, you tend to flock together. And I think we do need a better mix in terms of the individuals in the place. And this comes back to the point we made earlier. So in my view, the Labor Party has moved away from working people. They genuinely have, and I think they're onto them. And one of the reasons for that, in my view, is the individuals that they have in the parliament don't come from that background anymore. In the majority, they are not tradespeople. They don't come through the factory floor. They are, you know, lawyers who graduate, who go into an electorate office, who go to a minister's office, who win a pre-selection, who end up in this building. Now, that might be great, but I think it'd be better for the parliament to have a more diverse base to draw from.
It's probably on your own. It's a problem on all sides now, though.
It is. It is.
I mean, there is a distinct political class in Australia now, and that usedn't to be the case. I mean, you could, and I've invited you to reflect on media culture too. I'm not suggesting that we're not culpable in some of the conditions that have, you know, basically manifested themselves in the worst decade of political life I've ever witnessed.
But I think that's a financial imperative in terms of the media.
Well, it's a whole podcast where you and I could chew the fat on that. And that
I'm
would
sure.
Well, that would be hugely fun.
Next time round.
We can't really do that now. But it's I'm just saying I'm not putting it all on you, right, in this conversation. I'm not putting it all on you. It's not all about you. But this political class, you make a legitimate point about Labor and representation. It's also valid for your own side.
There's no doubt about that. And I think this is one of the challenges. And you'll probably find, and look, I can only talk about the Queensland LNP. I'm not involved in the, you know, the other state parties and the way they organise their pre-selections and how they run. But for me, you know, I came from outside. No one thought I'd win a pre-selection, including some of my own close family who I told you were no chance. But what came through from the local members was they wanted someone who understood what their life was like, who hadn't been caught in Canberra forever. And these are the things they said to me as they walked out of the pre-selection. Right, you've been through a few dry gullies was the description I usually got. I found a few more dry ones recently. And I think if we want the parliament to be a better place, well, it comes down to the people you send here. And, you know, if you're out there and you're in business or you're in a profession and you're earning good money, there's a lot of risk coming into this life because you effectively, over a very short period of time, lose those skills, lose those qualifications, you lose those opportunities to return to whatever it is that you did previously. Mm-hmm. If you're here for a long time, well, obviously they disappear very quickly. So I think, you know, you've got to strike that balance because if we expect people to come into the parliament to give up whatever it is they were doing before, and you know, once again, I'll be really frank, this is a great privilege. It really is. There are so few people who get the opportunity to do this job. But you've got to weigh up whether the privilege is worth more than the cost. And I think the cost to families in particular is too high. And I've said this publicly before. It's nothing new. And I'm not complaining, right? This is the gig. We know what we sign up for. But I think there are ways to make that easy to deal with. But unfortunately, the glare of the public eye usually tells you, you can't manage to pull that off.
And how do you think, in an ideal world, you could make it easier? How do you think you could do that?
Well, you know, I look at the Queensland Parliament, which now only sits, I think, for about 3 days a week for 12 weeks of the year, which, you know, in my view, is ridiculous. But a lot of things that have moved around public perception over, you know, and this is over 20 years, because I know previous parliamentarians, you know, their wives used to travel with them when they were overseas because you spend 30 weeks away as it is. And certainly if you're in a portfolio like trade, well, you spend 45 weeks away.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't see your family. It causes grief at home. And you know, to get acceptance from the public that there is a need, you know, to bring your family members down or with you or something out without the local press, you know, putting it on the front page of the paper that there was a family expenses of whatever the number was, you know, that's hard to get away from. So I think we just accept that you can't
do it. It's impossible.
Correct.
And but what about broadening the culture? What about in the gene pool? Sorry, I'm casting around for exactly the right word here, but
well, that comes back to the parties. All right, and there's a lot of parties here, right? They're all state-based, whether it's the Liberal Party, the Liberal National Party, the CLP, the Nats, Nation, it doesn't matter. You know, pick a party. It comes back to those individual members and the fact that their democratic rights to choose, I think, is the important part. And I know, once again, I can only speak for Queensland. The Queensland LNP are a true democratic party. I wouldn't be here if they weren't because there would have been some form of factional stitch-up and that would have been the end of that. But the reality is every individual member in Queensland gets a vote at a pre-selection. There's no limitation. If you've been in the party for 12 months, you get to vote.
All right.
And I think that does make a difference on who we put up. And, you know, once again, Queensland was incredibly successful at the last election. We have 29 members and senators in the joint party room. And I think that's a great reflection on what the government put forward in the last campaign.
What about? We'll end here. Getting back to that point about dissent and people being able to speak their minds, and the local dividend of being able to speak your mind and not be just like reciting dreadful talking points that everyone knows that you're reciting the dreadful talking points, because even before people leak them, it's obvious that you're reciting dreadful talking points. What do you think can be done about that?
Well, given that, you know, today is, you know, a day where they are recognising former Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who, you know, once again, I'll be blunt, wouldn't survive in the current political environment because of phones and Facebook and social media and everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
But he was recognised as being one of those characters that appealed to people. And it's hard to get that character out when you are stuck in a box of just listing off the lines on a piece of paper. To be honest, I try and avoid it wherever possible. I always stick with the theme. But you've got to have empathy for people. You've got to recognise when they are really, really doing it tough. And you've got to act on that. Mm. So, I mean, it's one of the things I really dislike. If I go and talk to someone and they repeat the talking points to me, well, I can read those. I don't need to have them verbalised. But there is a great case for discipline, because it's very easy to say something dumb and pay a very high price for it. So I can understand the need. There's no doubt about that, particularly in campaigns. If we are to do better, you need to let some of that free spirit reign. And I think, once again, yeah, Brother George is a great example of that. There's a few things that, you know, I wish he didn't do either. But we are all individuals here. And on our side, you know, we're not locked down by the union movement. We don't get disendorsed if we disagree. People might not be happy. But I think you have to be able to do what is necessary, particularly if you want to win elections. You have to appeal to your people, and you've got to act in their interests, and fundamentally that is our job as an MP.
Solid note to end on. Keith, thanks for your time.
Great to be with you.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thank you to Hannah Izzard for superb production this week. Remember the drill. Subscribe. Share the program if you like it. Tell your friends about it. All of that sort of jazz. We'll be back in the not too distant future with more from Canberra.